Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. And George Werthner is the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So first off, as always, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
You bet. Glad to be here.
So today we're going to talk about something called NARIPA. And can you tell people what NARIPA is and why it's important?
Yes. NARIPA is the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act. And NARIPA is legislation that's been introduced into Congress quite a few times at this point that would protect most of the roadless lands in the Northern Rockies. And the Northern Rockies is defined as, basically Western Montana, Northern Idaho, Northwest Wyoming, and a little bit of Eastern Oregon and Eastern Washington. So it covers five states and a total of 23 million acres. So it would be a very ambitious protection act. Probably the closest thing that's happened in the past was the Alaska National Lands Act that created all the new national parks, et cetera, in Alaska.
And can you give the history of this? Because I've heard about this for a long time.
Yeah. NARIPA began as an effort to protect the remaining roadless areas in those states that I mentioned. Almost 30 years ago, the Alliance for the Wild Rockies, which is one of the better, I would say probably the best environmental group in the region, decided that, they're constantly having to fight battles over logging this area or livestock grazing there and ORVs here. And that, you could spend your whole life fighting those things. And of course, the better way to do, to end your job, so to speak, would be to protect all those lands that qualify for wilderness under the 1964 Wilderness Act. And so they came up with the NARIPA bill, which is pretty comprehensive and has identified all the significant roadless areas in that region I mentioned. And proposes that they be protected as wilderness, but it goes beyond just a wilderness designation. It has a whole section on wild and scenic river designations. Wild and Scenic River Act is a separate act that Congress passed originally to prevent dams on rivers. But the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act has been expanded greatly over the years, and there will be some additional mileage of streams in the region added to that. Then they also have a section about restoration to take lands that have been significantly degraded by logging, logging roads and that sort of thing, and decommission the roads and try to assist a recovery of those areas so that at some point, maybe in the future, they could be designated as wilderness. And there's also a section about creating biological corridors. And as you probably know, you can set aside these large ecosystems and protect them, but you still want to be able to have primarily wildlife, but even plants move between them. And there are certain natural corridors that would connect the major ecosystems. So they wouldn't necessarily, the biological corridors may not be wilderness designation under the Wilderness Act, but would still be given protection and acknowledgement of existence under this act. So there are, just to rehash it or reiterate, are six major ecosystems that would be protected. Anyway, the greater Glacier Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the Salmon Selway ecosystem in Idaho, the Cabinet Yak Selkirk system, which is northwest Montana and northern Idaho, the Greater Hell's Canyon ecosystem, which would be eastern Oregon, and then the Island in the Sky wilderness, which is sort of eastern Montana. So basically, this legislation would address all those areas. And a lot of them have some pretty significant roadless areas. For example, down in Wyoming, you have some of the roadless areas there are 200,000-300,000 acres roadless still. So, but they're not protected by any legislation, and they're open for logging and drilling and livestock grazing and so forth. So there's the idea is to try to protect those areas while we still can before they're compromised significantly by new resource development. One other thing about the whole proposal is that it is the headwaters of three major rivers, the Columbia, the Snake, Columbia and Snake, then the Green, which flows into the Colorado, and the Missouri and Saskatchewan rivers in northern ecosystem. So that flows down in Missouri to the Gulf of Mexico and Saskatchewan up into Hudson's Bay. So by these are the headwaters, and so they're critical to all sorts of downstream users. And of course, protecting the lands from development will ensure clean water for those downstream wildlife and even economic users, cities, etc.
So let's go to sort of profound basics or to fundamentals. Yeah. And why is it important to protect wildlands from logging, grazing, et cetera? If somebody is completely new to this and they've lived their entire life in an apartment building in San Diego, why is this important? Not so much to them, but to wild nature. And sorry if this question is too basic.
No. I mean, that's the hope of this legislation is, and the primary purpose is to provide a habitat that will remain intact into the future for many species, from grizzly bears and wolves to bull trout and cutthroat trout, to various birds like sage grouse, and so what it would do is it would ensure that these wildlife species, and many that are I can't name because people wouldn't recognize because they're maybe less well known species, but many species depend on having large intact habitat, and they also depend on having, like I mentioned, the corridors that connect those habitats. And the problem with our human resource use is that we often compromise that habitat integrity. I'll give you an example. You put in a logging road into an area, and a logging road or any road actually may seem somewhat insignificant. But here's how it disturbs things. One, of course, it becomes a corridor for the establishment of weedy species because weeds like disturbed habitat. Well, a road is a disturbed habitat. It also disrupts the flow of water on a slope because you've cut across the slope with putting in the road, and that allows water to sort of leak out, you might say, of the subsurface layers and onto the road surface, which increases sedimentation flow and pollution of water. Roads also become people use the roads, whether it's even just for walking. It creates more human intrusions to an area, and there's plenty of studies that show that wildlife are disturbed by ORVs and mountain bikes and like I said, even hikers to a degree. So the more roads you have, even if they're blocked off later, the more disturbance you have to those sensitive animals. And roads also actually favor the spread of wildfires because two things. Reasons one, almost all wildfires in the West that are human caused are started along roads. And that's because of the access. And Once you've cleared out the trees there, you create sort of like a funnel effect that will increase the wind speed flowing down a road. And the road, because it doesn't have trees and shade, as often heats up as well. So it tends to favor the spread of fires. So, and that's just, I'm just hitting the surface of how, you know, a road can impact things. So protecting that land or designated as wilderness, which prohibits roads, will go a long ways towards preventing that kind of degradation. And that's only one source of degradation. And then, this is an aside, I should mention, currently in wilderness areas even, and this may surprise a lot of people, livestock grazing can continue. It's one of the few resource uses, you might say, that economic uses like that, that's allowed to continue, that has really significant degradation on our public lands. The one good thing about NAREPA regard livestock grazing is that it allows for the implementation of voluntary permit buyout. All these livestock grazing on public lands have what they call allotments that individual ranchers hold. And why grazing on public lands is a privilege, and I want to emphasize that there's no ownership that goes with a grazing permit. Nevertheless, because of the politics, it's really difficult to get rid of grazing anywhere, even in wilderness areas. So the voluntary permit buyout would hopefully hasten the removal of livestock grazing from wilderness areas. And wilderness areas are supposed to be managed for natural processes and natural species. So the idea of having cattle, which are exotic species, in wilderness is sort of counter to the whole purpose of the Wilderness Act. And that was a compromise to get the Wilderness Act passed back in 1964. And it was always hoped that it would be eliminated. It hasn't been, probably, won't happen anytime soon. So the voluntary permit buyout is the next best way to hopefully get rid of a lot of cattle grazing in wilderness areas.
So the next topic that you talked about was corridors. Can you give us a sort of quick primer on who would use corridors? Why are they important? What does a corridor consist of? If you have a wilderness area where no roads are allowed, then in the corridor, let's be honest, there's already interstates in between Yellowstone and Glacier. So how would a corridor actually, give us the basics of corridors.
Well, the corridor concept is that in order to ensure that populations, subpopulations don't get too isolated and therefore have genetic inbreeding and other complicating factors, a small population even is more likely to wink out due to random, events. You get a major drought for 20 years and you might have a small population disappear. But if there's a corridor connecting the larger roadless areas and therefore larger populations of any animal or plant, the theory is that plant or animal can move between places and gradually repopulate. For example, if there was an extinction, they could move back and repopulate naturally that area, or assist in, you might say, population rescue. In other words, you have a small population, it grew smaller, but it's not extinct yet. So if, grizzly bears are in one place and they're very limited in numbers, if there's a corridor and grizzly bears can move from, one ecosystem to another, it may be able to bring about the recovery of that population through population addition. So the idea behind corridors is to find the habitat that creates protected areas for that species to be able to, or species to move back and forth with as little interference as possible. So you mentioned the interstates, for example, and one of the things that's happening with that is increasingly we're building tunnels or bridges over these roads that are planted with natural vegetation and have sort of fencing and so forth to guide animals to them. And they've been very successful in the Canadian Rockies, for example. The Trans-Canadian Highway, it's a major four-lane highway, has any number of these tunnels or bridges built over and under them that allows wildlife to move back and forth without getting killed on the highway. And the animals learn to use it after a while. In other words, a grizzly bear mother might teach her cubs that this is where we cross over. And so they're able to get movement back and forth. So the whole idea of a corridor is to preserve that opportunity for movement of wildlife and plants between ecosystems and preserve long-term genetic viability of smaller populations.
So I want to ask one more question about corridors, which let's ignore the interstates for a moment. And you just have, generalized territory in Western Montana. So you got some ranches or houses. What would a corridor look like there? What would happen? A couple questions. One is, where I live, there is a creek that runs from the ocean up to the national park, and the area around it of, let's say a couple hundred yards is protected. And so that's all it takes here, actually, for bears, for example, to be able to walk from the ocean if they want to up to the national park. And it's only a couple hundred yards, and that is sufficient for them to be able to move through. Is this what we're talking about with corridors, or is it a much more, and all they had to do is say you can't build within 100 yards of the stream, basically? Is that what we're talking about, or is it more?
It can be as little as that, or it could be substantially larger. The main thing is that the corridor, which maybe would not qualify for wilderness designation because it's too few acres. You have to have a certain minimum acreage for wilderness usually. There may be even compromising uses in that corridor area. You mentioned livestock grazing would be an example of something that might continue to go on in a corridor that is not, that maybe even if there were a permit buyout in the wilderness, it would be eliminated there. A corridor in that sense can be as little as, 100 yards across, or it could be quite a bit wider. I mean, the general rule is the more substantial it is, the better the corridor will be. So if you had it several miles across, that would be better than 100 yards. But it would all depend on what is pre-existing. We can only work within the landscape as it exists. And it may get down to some places where you're talking about a corridor that's only 100 yards across or 100 feet wide. But that still might, animals will tend, a lot of them, particularly ones that are a little nervous around people, like you mentioned bears, will tend to, gravitate to those areas that are, forested or have significant vegetative cover to provide them a way to get through. And if the corridor is long enough, you also have to have things like water and food and other options besides just hiding cover, because some of these areas that we're talking about corridors for, they're going to be many, many miles long, not just something that may be crossed in one day. In fact, what you might have in a corridor, for example, you might have actually many populations of something. I'll just use something that's a smaller animal like sage grouse. You might have in that corridor a bunch of small populations of sage grouse that are interbreeding with the ones immediately next to it, which is then breeding with the one next to it, and so forth. But in any one place, there's not very many sage grouse. But because of the corridor and then a few larger protected areas along that corridor, it may be suitable to maintain a habitat viability for the species along the whole corridor's length.
So there's two directions I want to go now. One of them is just, you're talking about even hikers can disturb. And that reminds me of a time I was in my early 20s, and I was hiking or camping in the Rewa Wilderness area in Colorado, and I was having a wonderful time, and there were a couple hikers came, a couple other campers came by, and they were all perfectly reasonable, and everything was great. And then, honestly, there was one other group that destroyed my experience, and you could hear them from like two valleys over because they were shouting and just making so much noise. And I was thinking of, you know, if you're a shy non-human, or, you know, some non-human who is afraid of humans, that, you know, even that level of disturbance, this wasn't even including, you know, an ORV making a lot of, you know, two cycle engine noises or anything. Just how disturbing and loud some disturbances can be. That's all.
Well, yeah, I would say, you know, in general, hikers have a smaller, you might say, footprint for sure compared to anything that's mechanical because you can cover much greater distances and so forth. But the other part, of course, that you're talking about is individual behavior, and that is can be significantly different among different groups of people, and that individual behavior can determine how much impact or little impact you have. I would say on the whole that, you know, when I mentioned that hikers can have an impact, I don't want to say that's the big thing in a lot of places, because most hikers are usually confined to a trail corridor, which may in fact cause a problem along the corridor, but there will be lots of places that there are fewer people, wandering through that area. Whereas if you're on a mountain bike or you're on a motorcycle or a snowmobile, you can cover the distance that it might take a really strong hiker to do in a whole day. You can cover that distance in 1 hour or less. So your potential impact is much greater. And the thing about wilderness areas, in case your listeners don't know, is that mechanical transport is precluded in wilderness areas. So you can't have mountain bikes, you can't have ORVs, you can't have snowmobiles, pickup trucks, etc. And that really does reduce the human impacts in terms of effects on wildlife. It doesn't bring it down to zero, but it certainly does reduce it from what you would have on typically other public lands. So that's a good thing. You know, another thing I forgot to mention, I want to make this point right now, is that this legislation would also protect wilderness as wilderness within some of the existing national parks. People may not be aware of it, but Yellowstone Park, Glacier National Park, for example, both of them, even though the Park Service largely manages them as if they are designated wilderness, they are not. And this legislation would put both national parks, roadless areas, under protection of the Wilderness Act. About almost a little over 900,000 acres in Glacier National Park and somewhat over 2 million acres in Yellowstone would be designated as wilderness. And that would ensure that future development would be restricted. Now, it's important to point out that even wilderness designation is no long-term guarantee in one sense, in that wilderness is created by congressional action, legislation introduced into Congress and approved by Congress and signed by a president. But, you know, Congress can undo any legislation, too. I mean, it's the ultimate authority on what legislation is still in enforcement. But the experience is, for the most part, that if a place is designated as wilderness, it does not get undone as wilderness, except maybe very tiny areas along an edge or something like that to accommodate some little thing. There was a mountain bike trail, for example, that crossed a designated wilderness in New Mexico, and it got on that part of the wilderness got undesignated, which I didn't agree with, but anyway, it did pass, and so Congress can do that, but it takes congressional action, and it's difficult to get Congress to agree on anything. So the good thing is that it doesn't happen very often.
So in a moment, I want to go to the history of NARIPA and to its current prospects. Yeah. But before we do that, you seem like the perfect person to ask this question that I have for decades now, given how hostile so much of the government is to nature in general. I have marveled at the passage of the Wilderness Act in the first place. And how did something so smart and how did something so protective of nature ever happen? That just seems, it seems inconceivable to me. Does it seem inconceivable to you too at this point? And then also, how did it happen?
All right, well, the history of the Wilderness Act is pretty, it's a long history, actually. It sort of got its start with the creation of the Wilderness Society by Bob Marshall, Aldo Leopold, and Olus Murray, and a bunch of other early conservation luminaries, you would say, in the 1930s. And their goal was to set up a system that would preclude development. And Aldo Leopold was as a ranger in New Mexico, was able to persuade the local forest supervisor to protect the Gila area. Gila, it's called the Gila Wilderness today, from development. It was called I believe it was called the Gila Wilderness at that time, but it was just an administrative kind of thing. In other words, a new forest supervisor could come in and just undesignate it. So these early advocates for wilderness protection realized that there needed to be something that was a little stronger language that wasn't, you know, subject to the whims of just an individual forest supervisor or district ranger to ignore. So they started to advocate for the creation of a wilderness system. In the meantime, due to Aldo Leopold and Bob Marshall and so forth, there were primitive areas designated on Forest Service land. Primitive areas were basically forerunners of today's wilderness system. And a lot of the areas that are today under the 1964 Wilderness Act were early on designated as primitive areas. So, for example, the Sawtooth Wilderness in Idaho was the Sawtooth Primitive Area. The Three Sisters Wilderness in Oregon was the Three Sisters Primitive Area, and so forth. So a lot of these areas that today are under the Wilderness Act were primitive areas, but primitive areas had the same problem, which was they could be undesignated by an administrative decision. So they started the lobby for creating the wilderness system and legislation, and they had, I think it was 56 iterations of it written and introduced into Congress until it finally passed. And one of the compromises that I mentioned earlier with livestock raising, and that was because there was a congressman from Colorado who simply said, I'm not going to let this bill get passed unless you allow livestock raising to continue. So that was one of the compromises with the original legislation. Another compromise that was put in there was to allow mining claims to be designated in proposed and designated wilderness for 20 years. And then it was to be not continued, which, in fact, it has not been since then. But so there were a number of compromises, and it took until 1964 to, you know, all the ducks to line up in a row and enough people to support it that it was passed and signed into law. And you mentioned, is this, you know, unusual? Well, I would say a lot of legislation is just luck. and you know, I say it's the stars line up, and this is how I look at NARIPA too, that there can be a lot of opposition to things, and then suddenly that opposition disappears for a host of reasons, or it becomes advantageous for members of Congress to support some legislation that maybe previously they had not. I don't want to go too far in trying to make an analogy with today's, controversies, but the limited stuff that is looks like in gun control that was recently passed is an example. I mean, some of the things in there were in that legislation that still has to be signed into law, but is people thought would never get into law to begin with. And so sometimes things happen that will promote this. And one of the real critical things with NARIPA, I think, that is sort of working in its favor, besides the fact that it would protect all this wildlife habitat, is that it's, you know, most of the stuff that's in this bill, most of the lands in this bill, if they had been valuable for resource extraction interests, whether it's, you know, mineralized or oil wells or logging or any of those other types of resource extraction, they probably would have been developed already. So that's, you know, for better or for worse, we're getting the lands that did not, you know, lend itself to resource development. And the second thing is that a lot of these lands are forested and would be substantial carbon storage, which if Congress ever does get serious about trying to protect, you know, the planet from by reducing carbon emissions, you know, one of the easiest and quickest ways that you could make a significant contribution towards that long-term goal would be protecting all these lands in NARIPA. So that might be, for example, at some point, if Congress ever gets really serious about climate warming, they may see this as an easy thing for them to, you know, to pass so they can all go home and say, look at, I'm doing good things for climate. And I don't want to be too glib about it, but I'll take any reason they give for passage. And that might be the rationale that gets people on board who would otherwise not support it.
So what is the legislative history of this? Has it ever had, let's go to the past first and then bring it up to the present. Has it ever had significant support in Congress? And I'm not talking about Alliance for Wild Rockies. I'm talking about actually Congress. Has it had significant support? And to this day, does it have significant support?
It has in the past had more co-signers than a lot of other legislation that has been introduced along the similar lines. So, you know, it varies from year to year. So I can't tell you what the past number of congressmen that have supported it in the past with it. Right now, as of about a week ago or so, there were at least 70 co-sponsors in the House and 12 Senate co-sponsors. And so that, you know, that is a good start with any legislation to get that many co-signers. Obviously, you know, you're going to need several hundred co-signers in the House and, you know, probably 60 senators to get this through Congress. But the way that legislation like this has been dealt with lately, for better or for worse, is they usually pull together what they call public lands legislation into one bill that deals with, you know, 15, 20, 30 different things, whether it's, you know, creating a new wildlife refuge somewhere or maybe even deleting some public land to, you know, transfer to some community, some BLM land or whatever. So anything to do with public lands will be all mixed together into one legislative package. The advantage of that is that you've got some congressman in, I'll just make something up, in Nevada, who wants to see some BLM land added to the outskirts of Las Vegas so that it can potentially, you know, expand the city of Las Vegas even more. Well, they may not care about the Northern Rockies at all, but if this is in the same legislative package, they're going to vote for it because they can go home to their constituency in Las Vegas and say, I got some extra BLM land undesignated as federal land to add on to Las Vegas and so forth. So what the good thing is you have to have these pieces of legislation out there, because if they're out there, as NARIPA is, and it has been introduced, it can be thrown into the pot with all these other public lands legislation. And that's probably how this will be passed at some point. In other words, it will not be passed as a standalone piece of legislation as much as mixed into a bigger, you know, soup mix, so to speak, of all sorts of public lands issues that will then be passed by Congress. And almost somebody in every state will have a senator who has some interest in that bill. And you'll have hundreds of congressmen and congresswomen who have some interest in the legislation. And that's how they get these things through.
That reminds me of 20 years ago, I wrote something about sort of a history of, I think it was the B-1 bomber in the 70s, the funding of it. And one of the things that the defense industry, the military industry did that was really smart was basically they would scatter all of the parts manufacturers basically in every district in the country.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. And, you know, and that's exactly how other, you know, like the agricultural bills that get passed. One of the ways that, you know, you get all these subsidies for farmers and ranchers is that you also throw into it, issues related to, funding food programs in urban areas or whatever. So you get some congressman whose district is New York City will support, you know, the ag bill that, you know, provides benefits to some rancher in Nevada because they're going to get something for their constituency in New York City. Yeah, that's how it is. And that's how this will be too, probably. It'll be mixed into, a bunch of legislation that'll have probably a lot of things that you and I wouldn't agree with actually being put in the same pot as NARIPA. But the good thing about it would be that this would definitely protect large amount of areas and take away from the fact that you're constantly battling all the time to try to prevent bad things from happening. And the Alliance for the Wild Rockies does an incredible job that way, that is filing lawsuits against timber sales and other developments on public land. But someday they may not be around. And, this would, if this passes, it will greatly reduce the need for that kind of watchdog monitoring. Or the other way you could look at it is then people can focus on other issues that are equally important that right now sort of get overlooked or don't get the attention they need because people are trying to stop a timber sale here or keep an oil wells out of another area.
And is there a huge what is the opposition doing to this bill? What is the opposition to this bill doing?
Well, the irony is, some of the opposition is the lack of support by many national and regional groups. The main thing I hear is, oh, well, this is so large, it's not practical. On the other hand, I can show you it's almost as hard to get just a single little wilderness area protected as it would be this whole legislation. So I feel like that argument doesn't hold. But, the other argument or problem is that the five states that we're talking about, particularly the districts, the Eastern District of Oregon, the Eastern District of Washington, plus Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, Congress people are pretty hostile to any kind of protection. And the senators in most of those states, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho are not very pro protection either. So that, they generally see themselves as being, working for the oil companies or the timber companies or whatever. So that hurts it. But on the other hand, and I don't want to, make too much of this, but there's an increasing understanding by people in even those regions like Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming that protected landscapes have economic benefits. It has two economic benefits. One, it prevents wasting money on things that are detrimental, like timber sales that are lose money and do damage to the landscape. And a lot of people are attracted to places with wildlands and wildlife. And so whether that's somebody who wants to fish a river and catch trout, well, you got to have clean water for that. Or just somebody who's living in the valley and the Bitter Valley and looking up at the mountains and not seeing clear cuts there. Well, that increases the value of that private property in a sense. So there's an increasing recognition of that, and therefore some support among businesses and other organizations for this protection, because they realize in the long run it's to their economic interest, both in, like I said, the savings of wasted funding on things that make no sense, as well as the increased value of the private lands and businesses that operate in these areas.
Well, I'm actually,
that is not the reason I want to see it protected, but I can still make that argument.
I totally agree with you. And also, I'm an example of that twice, that I moved to North Idaho in the 80s because it was one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life. And then in the late 90s, I moved down to far northern California for the same reason. And it's you know, that has had, and again, I care about nature, not the economy, but that had economic benefits in both places.
Exactly. And so...
And I would not move to North Idaho. I would not move to North Idaho now because there's way too many people.
Right. And I mentioned the climate warming, the storage, the carbon storage is worth, you know, an incredible amount of money in that you lock up carbon for a long time in trees and in the roots and in the ground, soil and so forth. And that value is probably the most valuable thing about the NREPA is how it will work for in terms of helping us meet climate goals in reducing the greenhouse warming gases that we're emitting. And as long as we have these trees out there growing and even if they get killed by something like wildfire, they're still storing carbon. And so in the long term, this its most greatest value might be in terms of carbon storage.
So we have like a minute left. So what can people... Like the person I mentioned who might live in San Diego, what can they do?
Yes. The thing you can do is I would go to the Alliance for the Wild Rockies website. Just Google Alliance for the Wild Rockies. And you can see a list of supporters of NREPA. And if one of your congresspersons or senators is one of the supporters, write them a letter and thank them. If they're not, write your congressional person a letter and say you support NREPA, and you would be surprised. I've talked to Congress people about this, and sometimes they get one or two letters on some issue, and they don't know anything about it, and the one or two letters is enough to get them aware of it, and that often will, you know, if they have no reason not to vote for it, become a supporter and vote for it. So I really encourage people to write their congressional representatives. Believe it or not, sometimes the letters do have an effect. And it's certainly worth doing. And then tell your friends about NREPA. And so go to Alliance for Wild Rockies and then write your letter to Congress.
Great. Well, thank you, as always, for your work in the world. And thank you for another really good conversation. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.